court is ready to hear argument in 060322, Owens and Minor Inc., Owens and Minor Medical Inc. versus Ansel Healthcare Products and Becton Dickinson.
May it please the court, Mr. Lennon will present argument for the appellants. Not to reserve 5 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Bob Redmond. I'm honored to represent Owens and Minor in this matter. We respectfully request that this court respond to the Fifth Circuit as follows. We ask that the court state that the manufacturer of an allegedly defective product owes an independent duty to defend, indemnify, and hold harmless an innocent seller of the allegedly defective product, and that the manufacturers can seek contribution from other statutory manufacturers. We think that this case addresses three important points, which I'd like to cover this morning.
Have you seen the Celine Medical case that
was
put up here this morning?
We have, Your Honor. And actually, Celine, we think, ties into one of the points I'd like to make here, and that is that the duty to indemnify is triggered by the injured claimant's pleading, and the scope of that duty is set by the injured claimant's pleading. And I'd like to get to that in just a moment, but the other two points I'd like to cover are, number one, and the most important point, is that the purpose of Section 82.002 is to protect innocent sellers in product liability actions by assigning all costs of that product liability litigation to the manufacturers. And that's stated by this court in its three seminal cases. It is also stated in the plain language of the statute itself and in the legislative history. The second point is that the statutory duty under Section 82.002 is a duty owed by the manufacturers to the seller and not to the product. That's a key analytical point that we think the federal district court missed when it interpreted this case. And the last point, which I've already discussed, is that the timing and the scope of the indemnity obligation is set and triggered by the injured claimant's pleading. Addressing the first point as to the purpose, this court has stated the legislative purpose of 82.002 three separate times. First, in Meritor, this court stated that the legislative purpose was to pass the cost of product litigation from an innocent seller to the product manufacturers. 2 years later, this court stated...
But we didn't have in mind this situation where the circuit wouldn't certify the question.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think the principle is what's important, and that's why I believe that the court, the Fifth Circuit, certified this question. Carry through the principle from a situation as in Fitzgerald where the manufacturer owed a duty to indemnify a seller who did not distribute the product.
But it's quite another thing to say a manufacturer should indemnify the seller for all the other manufacturers.
Well, Your Honor, I think that really goes to the third point, which is that you have to look to the petition, the injured claimant's pleading. And in this case, the injured claimant's pleading broadly alleged product liability claims against Owens & Minor for distributing latex gloves, and broadly alleged industry-wide allegations against the manufacturers of those gloves. So the issue then is, when does a duty trigger? And the principle that the duty triggers on the injured claimant's pleading is a principle that is appropriate and then applies in this case.
And but they alleged 13 manufacturers were liable, right?
Your Honor,
And you picked out a few of those to sue for indemnity.
That's not quite correct, Your Honor, and the reason is this. First off, the quote 13 manufacturers is 13 sellers of gloves. They include importers like Microflex. They include reassemblers or packagers like Medline. They included certain companies for whom Owens & Minor did not have a historical relationship. And in the Fitzgerald dissent, one of the criticisms of the dissent was that a distributor could sue a manufacturer whose product they never sold. So we interpreted that as a limitation of the right to sue certain manufacturers.
And in fact, but you also think you could sue any one of them and collect against any one of them.
Your Honor, we believe that we could sue any manufacturer for whom we had a relationship before the lawsuit and could collect because the duty is triggered on the injured claimant's plea. We believe that that is, in fact, the case. Because the reason that is so is because the language used by the legislature when it wrote the statute, shall indemnify and hold harmless, puts the burden on the manufacturers to assume all costs. That's the phrase, hold harmless. Hold harmless means...
I'm sorry, go ahead. So manufacturer has to assume all risk on a product that is could be, for example, this is a tissue paper. People may know that as Kleenex, but if you manufacture tissue paper and somehow it's defective and maybe have some asbestos fiber in it, every manufacturer of that has to respond to that request for indemnification when the plaintiff's pleadings aren't clear as to which manufacturer's product may have caused that injury?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that it's correct. If the plaintiff's pleadings allege broad industry-wide allegations, then a seller of that product, if Owens & Minor sold Kleenex, for example, and sold another brand, it could go and ask indemnification and not even have to ask. Under the statute, the duty to indemnify is triggered by the plaintiff's pleading and the joinder of seller as defendant. In this case, we had Beck and Dickinson and Hansel were already named defendants in the pleading, so they had statutory notice. And when Owens & Minor was served with that petition, that duty triggered. We didn't have to ask, but that duty is triggered at that point, and it is an independent duty as to each manufacturer.
Are their products exactly the same, or
in the way the
differences?
The way the petition was alleged is that latex gloves are defective. The petition that Ms. Burden filed in this case did not segregate any manufacturer's product from any other manufacturer's product.
But in fact, are they?
The plaintiffs did not allege that. The plaintiffs alleged that the causative agent was latex proteins. Now, some of the manufacturers in various cases in discovery argued that their gloves had fewer latex proteins than others. But all latex gloves, all natural rubber latex gloves, have proteins. And the plaintiff's allegations were that these proteins are what cause this type 1 systemic allergy. So to that extent, it is analogous to asbestos. And frankly, the way the plaintiffs prosecuted these claims was very similar to asbestos claims. Industry-wide allegations against distributors, importers, wholesalers, manufacturers, without segregating any particular brand out, based on workplace exposure, very similar to asbestos litigation as it's been prosecuted in Texas and throughout the country. These are broad-based, industry-wide claims. Owens & Minor is an innocent seller. It's an undisputed fact in this case. Owens & Minor, first off, when it did what its job was to do, it was simply moving sealed packages from a warehouse to a hospital, typically in sealed pallets, so it really had no action whatsoever on the product itself. But in this case, it is even more of an innocent seller because Owens & Minor did not distribute any gloves to any of Plaintiff Burden's work sites. That's in contrast, for example, to Ansel, where Ms. Burden specifically cited Ansel gloves as gloves that she used, and that's in the record at 839, 840, 844. But Owens & Minor is an innocent seller, and under this court's jurisprudence, an innocent seller is entitled to reimbursement of all costs. That's in the Meritor case. All costs means everything. And that means that the duty is triggered at the time of the petition. The duty cannot be segregated, parceled out, or divided. The duty is owed from the first day Owens & Minor was served with that complaint or the petition until Owens & Minor was dismissed by the plaintiff of all liability. Even then, Owens & Minor, because it did not obtain its defense from the manufacturers, Owens & Minor had to seek out the manufacturers and obtain indemnification, and in fact did make settlements with three manufacturers. The remaining two here, Ansel and BD, did not settle.
The only exception to this blanket indemnity is loss caused by the seller's negligence, and that's it.
That is correct, Your Honor, and that's stated by this court, both in Meritor and recently in General Motors Corporation versus Hudeberg Chevrolet Kids. The court stated that the only way the manufacturer can escape the duty to indemnify is to prove that the innocent seller is independently negligent. That's the one escape, so to speak. Although the court did make an important distinction in Hudeberg, and that is that allegations that are not fairly raised in the plaintiff's petition are not covered by the duty to defend. And if there is a specific allegation that is not raised, then the manufacturer does not have that duty. That goes back to the third point, that is that the meets and bounds of the duty to defend are set by the plaintiff's petition.
Have you addressed the ceiling case here in your response?
I'd like to address it right now, Your Honor, because it's I think it ties in well with the third point. In the ceiling case, Ceiling was a seller of a medical device. The device was a combination of a walker and a platform. Plaintiff Daiza sued CLM, the walker manufacturer Invacare, and the platform manufacturer Grandfield. At trial, before trial, in a no evidence summary judgment motion, the walker manufacturer sought summary judgment in a no evidence motion against the plaintiff to show that the walker was not defective. At that time, CLN, the distributor, brought an 82.02 claim against the walker manufacturer. The walker manufacturer prevailed on its no evidence summary judgment motion. The court threw out the claim against the walker manufacturer. Baeza then amended his petition, removed all allegations whatsoever against the walker manufacturer, and continued forward only on his claim against the platform manufacturer and the seller, CLN. What's significant about the CLN case is that the Eastman Court of Appeals said that the duty to indemnify the distributor was triggered on Plaintiff Baeza's petition. So the duty triggered as soon as CLN was served with that petition that alleged the walker was defective. The duty continued even after the court entered summary judgment in favor of the walker manufacturer and only terminated when the petition was amended. So CLN is a perfect example of why the plaintiff's petition establishes the scope of the duty to defend. In other words, it sets the boundaries of the duty to defend.
Okay. Would the duty to defend be different? As I read this case, it seems on point, but it also, my reading, involved what could be a component part or it could be a subproduct ancillary to the main product that was distributed. Does this rule of indemnification apply to a manufacturer of any product that also contains components that are manufactured by another company?
Well, I think that's correct, Your Honor, and that really ties into the General Motors Corporation case. If the plaintiff's petition fairly raises an allegation against a component product, whether by name or by description, then that is covered by the duty to defend, and the duty to defend would apply both to the finished product manufacturer and to the component manufacturer. In this case, in the Sealing case, as I read the case, it sounded as if the plaintiff brought the claim against the combination product, two separate products, the walker and the platform. And then when he amended his petition, he deleted all reference whatsoever to the walker and only proceeded forward on the platform. So again, it ties into the fact that the plaintiff's petition establishes the boundaries of the duty to defend. And in this case, the plaintiff's petition makes broad-based, industry-wide allegations against the sellers, manufacturers, wholesalers, and importers of latex gloves. Therefore, under this court's jurisprudence, the duty to defend triggered when Owens & Minor was served with Kathy Burden's petition. That duty continued on until Owens & Minor was dismissed from that case. Ansel and BD had a duty to defend that was triggered as soon as Owens & Minor was served, and that duty continued throughout. They did not assume that duty, and as a result, the second part of the statute comes into play, and that is they have to reimburse Owens & Minor for its reasonable defense costs. As this court is probably aware, these facts were all played out in a full trial in another case called McCabe and the Frick pleadings, but it's out of the Sixth Court of Appeals, and it's on petition for review in this case. And in that case, the petition was basically a verbatim copy. Ansel and BD did not assume the defense. In that case, the trial court out of Texarkana had a bench trial and determined the reasonableness and the necessity of the fees and awarded Owens & Minor a judgment of $351,000. And the reason that these two cases are important is because it sets the issue squarely before this court of whether the plaintiff's petition is what sets the scope of the duty to defend, or whether the duty to defend can be divided out, parceled out, or can be addressed, as the federal district court in this case felt, that the duty could be addressed simply by the manufacturer defending itself. What the federal district court held in this case is that a manufacturer's defense of its own product implicitly defends the distributor. And unfortunately, what that does is simply removes the statute from the law altogether. At common law, all a manufacturer's duty was to defend its own product. That's what the federal district court held in this case. whereas this court has stated expressly several times and in detail that 82.002 is a new and distinct statutory duty that is in addition to and on top of the common law. And in fact, that's clear right from the language of the statute. And this court has said the common law sheds little light on the duties under 82.002. And the Dallas Court of Appeals said it perhaps more colorfully. It said that 82.002 turns the common law on its head. I see my time's up. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the appellee.
May it please the court, Ms. Von Hatchell and Mr. Epstein will present argument for the appellees. Mr. Hatchell will open the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court, I represent Ansell Healthcare Products. My friend and colleague, Mr. Epstein, represents Beckton Dickinson. If Mrs. Burden or any plaintiff had brought her action against 10 manufacturers in 10 different counties in Texas, or as 10 separate lawsuits in the same court, we wouldn't be here today contending that Ansell and Beckton Dickinson had the obligation to intervene in those actions and offer a defense to manufacturers of products that they didn't make. And Owens & Minor does not address how the interpretation and application of 82.002 so radically changes to make us liable not only for defending claims against products we make, but defending claims against products made by other manufacturers. And we must submit that there is no difference, and there should not be any difference. The problem comes from, I think, Owens & Minor's failure to understand what 82.002 is all about. Owens & Minor would tell you that it's an indemnity statute, and then at the end of the road, I guess it is. But what the statute really is a defend or indemnify statute. The primary goal, if you look at 82.003 in conjunction with 82.002, is to get the innocent, truly innocent seller out of the mix as soon as possible. And the way that is done is by giving manufacturers notice of the suit or they acquire suit. They come in, they defend their product, and they get a summary judgment in favor of their distributor, and perhaps they settle, and they're out of the case. Well, the primary object is not, the penalty is indemnity. If you don't do that, then you're obligated to indemnify. Well, the purpose of the act is just rent asunder in this case, because we can do everything the statute wants us to do. We can come in, we can offer to defend our product, we can get a summary judgment on behalf of Owens & Minor. We can even settle our portion of the action, and you would think we would be able to go home scot-free. But under Owens & Minor's interpretation, we are stuck there for the rest of the litigation, for however many years it takes, and we're liable for all of the defense costs racked up against 10 manufacturers or by 10 manufacturers, or we have to come in and actually offer to take over the defense of products that are competing with us for whose proprietary information we cannot get. So that's number one.
Under Fitzgerald, you agree that even though Ms. Burden didn't use perhaps your products or Beckton's products, you still had to defend Owens against her charges that
no
these
question,
were defective.
No question that that's the case, and from a policy standpoint, I can accept that. I was counsel in the Hearst case, which was partially overruled in that case, but I think from a policy standpoint, the court was on solid ground. So number one, I say the purpose of the act is rent asunder. Number two, I say the structure of the act supports our position and is contrary to Owens & Minor's position. There, in the structure created by the legislature, there must be under the definition of manufacture, a release of a product into the stream of commerce, I do not owe indemnity. Even if I'm a defendant in the case, if I have not released a product into the stream of commerce. And the second thing is that the indemnity must inhere in a product liability action. So there must be an allegation, according to the specific terms of 82.002, that my product is defective and I released it into the stream of commerce. When you read those two together, as Mr. Justice Medina, I think the Sealing Court did do, and did do very brilliantly, I think, that limits the indemnity obligation to one claim against one manufacturer for the release of one product. But what has Owens and Minor said that we are obligated to do in this case? They say that we are obligated to defend claims against products that we did not release into the chain of commerce, into the stream of commerce. And I think that that just breaks the structure of the Act irreparably. And the third thing that we say is that Owens and Minor's position in this case leads to very absurd results. I think that this Court has come to the lip of the cup on at least two occasions in saying that the situation that we have here today is an absurd result that we cannot attribute to be the intent of the legislature. The first occurred in the Fitzgerald case, which was a 5-4 decision. And Justice Owens' dissent in that case threw up the notion that our interpretation of 82.002 requires manufacturers to defend all other manufacturers. I mean, would say that the seller could claim indemnity from all manufacturers. And in rebutting that, Justice Gonzalez says, our construction of the plain language of Section 82.002 must avoid absurd results, if the language will allow. Only manufacturers of a product alleged by a plaintiff to have been defective are subject to a claim of indemnity. And there is no allegation in this case that we have put into the stream of commerce any glove manufactured by any other than our own. So I think that what Justice Gonzalez was doing in Fitzgerald was essentially anticipating the case that you have today and saying, that's an absurd result. They didn't sue multiple manufacturers in that case, so we don't reach the issue, but it would be absurd to make the contention. And then I think Mr. Justice Heck comes extremely close to our situation, again in Hudibird, speaking for this court, when he says, very simply, the claimant's pleadings must fairly allege a defect in the component itself, not merely a defect in the seller's product of which the component is a part. Now, we're not dealing with components in this case, but in my judgment, substantively, there is no difference. We have not been alleged to have released a defective product by Becton Dickinson or any other manufacturer into the stream of commerce. I think that the court, again, in Hudibird, which I think can be laid almost on top of this case, was clearly speaking to this situation and putting borders and fences around the indemnity obligation in the way that I have said. And let me give you, I know that my good friend and colleague, Mr. Epstein, is going to talk to you about the consequences because he lives this on a day-to-day basis. But consider two very drastic consequences from Owens and Minor's position in this case. The first is joint and several liability. Under their interpretation, again, I can come in, I can defend my product, I can vendor claims against my product, I can get my distributors out of the case. But what happens if I do that and the litigation goes on for 10 more years, as the famous toxic cloud case in East Texas did? I have to stand in the wings and await my turn to pay all of the defense costs racked up against every other manufacturer And if they get hit for hundreds of millions of dollars, I'm jointly and severally liable for that, and yet I have done everything the statute requests me to do. Absurd result number one. Absurd result number two is forcing me, again, remembering that this is a statute that wants me to come in and defend. It forces me to come in and say, Becton Dickinson, I'm taking over the defense of your gloves and give me all your proprietary information. That, in my judgment, is a business disaster that the legislature simply could not have understood.
Does a decision in this case decide the case adversely?
Yes, in my judgment, it does. There are more facts. Because of the way the cases were done, this is a bare-bones summary judgment, which, by the way, does bring up one of your questions, Your Honor. The gloves are not identical. And, in fact, the differences play out. And Mr. Epstein is a little more familiar with that. But the differences are very, very important, and they are a prime reason why some distributors choose to distribute some gloves and not others, because powders and allergen levels and things. My time has expired. I don't want to trust the phone. I go, counsel.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from Mr. Epstein.
May it please the court. As Mr. Hatchell said, I've been in these cases for about 9 years, so the practical consequences of what Owens & Minor has asked for strike the very close to the heart.
Well, how are these gloves different, and how have you handled these type of claims over the last 9 years?
Natural rubber latex gloves became an essential health product because of the blood-borne diseases that it prevents, AIDS, what have you. They protect both the physician and the patient because these things run both ways. Many, many manufacturers got into the business of producing these gloves, and they differ all over the place. They differ in the manufacturing techniques. They differ in how they wash them, how they prepare them. They differ in the thickness. They differ in the tensile strength, that is how you can feel. For example, if you have a glove that you're using for orthopedic surgery, it has to be thick, because you're dealing with bones. If you're using it for microsurgery, you have to have very thin.
So how is the consumer able to determine that?
The consumer doesn't determine that. What each manufacturer puts a different glove into the stream of commerce.
But does each one have latex protein that was the basis of the plaintiff's suit?
Each one has latex protein, but not all of them have enough latex protein that they're allergenic.
Which is the same sort of argument these comparatives to the asbestos cases, where it's difficult to tell exposure levels to which products, and that therefore this sort of 8202 scheme makes particular sense in that situation.
Well, it actually has nothing to do, frankly, with the allergenic level of the various gloves, because each in the complaint, in the petition, it's alleged that there were ways to reduce the allergenic level that some manufacturers did and some manufacturers did not. There are differences. It's not all asbestos is not the same as all protein. The protein can be reduced so that it's not allergenic and not harmful. There really are no comparisons, and asbestos cases, with all due respect, Your Honor, really should not be analogized to these. What really is
Well, I guess you don't realize that until you get much beyond the pleadings and much further down the road.
Well, yeah, I understand that. But on the other hand, the pleadings themselves recognize differences. The pleadings, for example, this is in the complaint in paragraph 53, about safer alternative designs existed which reduced or eliminated the ultimate user's exposure to harmful ingredients. So it implicates, and it talks about each manufacturer throughout here. So it implicates the differences, and these are the defenses, and they're much different from manufacturer to manufacturer based upon the petition itself. So the petition doesn't go and say there's a uniform industry problem. Much to the contrary, it says the opposite. The basic premise of our argument on 8202 is that as written, Your Honors, it can be applied very easily to multiple manufacturers and has been. What happens under 8202. If the innocent seller comes to you, or if you're named in the petition, you go to that seller and say, we will defend and indemnify you pursuant to our obligation under 8202. In these cases, every manufacturer, especially in the situation where we have been dealing with O&M for a long time and deal with them on a commercial basis, went to O&M and said, we will defend and indemnify you. As a matter of fact, in most cases that I'm aware of, certainly in BD's and in sales case, we covered them under our own insurance policy under a vendor's endorsement. That vendor's endorsement, which was applicable all over the country, not only in Texas where we have this statute, provided that almost like this statute, that the vendor's endorsement covered O&M for any problem, any liability they might have, with the exception of their own negligence, very much like 8202. So that in this commercial setting, there simply was no need. It was not necessary for O&M to pick or select two manufacturers out of a whole bunch and say, you're responsible for our entire defense for stranger manufacturers' products when we have absolutely no ability to defend stranger manufacturers' products. So this is the issue that is faced, and an issue that is, I think, really unnecessary for this court to have dealt with if O&M just followed the procedure set forth by the law. In Fitzgerald...
Well, if you had an insurance policy that covered them
right.
for products liability claims
right.
Alleging that one of your products was defective, would that policy not defend them as long as you were in the lawsuit?
Sure, it defends them, and we are the ones that...
So what's the difference between that policy and what this statute says?
I don't know of any difference. I mean, they duplicate each other in a sense. O&M has its own insurance.
Is if the policy would cover them regardless of the number of co-defendant manufacturers, why does the statute not do the same?
Oh, it covers them only for our product.
Only for your product?
Yes, we have a policy that...
For the insurance...
Right, the
vendor says only for your product.
Oh, sure.
But this statute doesn't say that, does it?
Well, the statute, of course, I believe the statute says it very firmly, and I think Fitzgerald says it, because the statute says, as Mr. Hatchell pointed out, the only products that we are responsible to indemnify for are products that we put in the stream of commerce.
Does your insurance policy specifically say that it covers them only for allegations related to your products?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, just imagine if in a situation like this, which is uncontrolled, you tried to buy insurance on a commercial basis to insure for any product they might sell that happened to be sued on in a given case. You could not get such insurance. They could never figure out what kind of premium to charge. It's just not available on the market. So this has a very practical application. In Fitzgerald, this court said, on its face, the statute requires a manufacturer who allegedly produced the defective product to indemnify certain sellers for reasonable products liability litigation costs, except for those due to the seller's own fault. So it was the manufacturer who allegedly produced the defective product. That comes right out of the statute, because the statute defines a manufacturer as one who produced the product. In effect, there is no... Becton-Dickinson is not a manufacturer or a statutory 8202 manufacturer vis-a-vis Ansel's product. We do not qualify under the statute, and the requirement to indemnify never arises because we did not put their product in the stream of commerce. And then, more to your question also, Your Honor, in Fitzgerald, this court said, viewed in context, 8202 is part of a scheme to protect manufacturers as well as sellers. First, the new law ensured that the relatively small seller need not fear litigation involving problems that are not really in its control. Second, it established uniform rules of liability so that manufacturers could make informed business decisions and plaintiffs could understand their rights. One of those informed business decisions is getting insurance for the seller that sells your product. That's what a vendor's endorsement does. They're commonplace. And that's what we have. As a matter of fact, in the record, I think in the in the McCabe case, which has been cited too, the request came, but we call your attention to it in our brief, the request came to us under the vendor's endorsement, the request for coverage and
well, it seems like the vendor's endorsement didn't kick in, otherwise we probably wouldn't be here. What happens in a situation, and I think I asked this on the other side, when you distribute a product that's very generic, I don't know if these latex gloves are generic or not, I don't know the chemical makeup, but you say they're different, the consumer doesn't know they're different, and distributor A distributes products for every manufacturer of these gloves in the entire world. And plaintiff doesn't know which product caused their illness, and neither does the distributor. Are the manufacturers of the product on the hook through the entire case?
First, I'd like to answer your first comment, where you said the vendor's endorsement did not kick in, otherwise we wouldn't be here. That isn't exactly what happened. What happened is OZM did not let the vendor's endorsement kick in, because rather than go with the vendor's endorsement or with our agreement to defend them under 8202 or similar rules, they said defend us not only for your own product, defend us for everybody's product, even stranger products, products that are not covered under the vendor's endorsement or under 8202. In effect, they prevented our exercise of our desire to defend and indemnify them, one which was repeated over and over again by Ansel, by ourselves, by all of the manufacturers. This was not something that came to us out of the blue that we did not understand. This is sophisticated companies doing business with a very sophisticated company. This is a
counsel.
A
your time has expired.
Oh, excuse me. I was answering the question.
You might want to answer his second question about the vendor for the world.
I frankly can't get my arms around that question. I think we cannot, with all due respect, Your Honor, understand how to defend anybody else except ourselves. And so it is not a possibility under the circumstances available to us to go out and defend anybody but our own client with its own documents, its own in-house witnesses, its own manufacturing techniques, and everything else, and understand that case. We just cannot, on justice, defend them on any rational basis.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to. Appreciate it.
May it please the Court, if I may address first Mr. Hatchell's hypothetical. He initially raised a hypothetical of 10 different lawsuits with 10 different manufacturers, and does Becton Dickinson and Ansel have to intervene in each one? And of course the answer is no, because the duty to indemnify is set by the plaintiff's petition. So in a lawsuit, Owens & Minor and Johnson are sued, Owens & Minor is entitled to indemnification from Johnson & Johnson. And there would be, of course, no reason for Becton Dickinson and Ansel.
Do you think the duties to defend and the duties to indemnify are identical?
Yes.
Well, and how do you address the concern that you can end up with one manufacturer defending another manufacturer's product?
That, first off, that is what we would have to do if they don't defend us. That's what we as a distributor have to do if they do, as they did in this case, and not defend us. We have to, because we distributed products by other manufacturers, we have to defend that product through vicarious liability, and that is exactly why the 82.02 makes sense.
But you've got a relationship with both of those. They don't. These are competitors. They don't have relationships with one another.
Well,
or they better not under the antitrust laws.
Well, yes and no, Your Honor. The fact of the matter is that Becton Dickinson and Ansel were in the joint manufacturing group, and we're sharing experts, discovery. As you can see from the court, can see from all the letters that went back and forth. We were specifically told to wait.
Which they asked you to do, too. Well, they asked you, if you've got 10 manufacturers and 8 of them say we'll represent you, so you've only got 2 left, then what you need to do is not defend the whole case, but let them do most of the case, and just if they start pointing the finger at the 2 guys that are left, then you have an attorney there to speak up and say no. But otherwise you end up just duplicating the stuff, and unless everybody agrees on your terms,
you get a free lawyer, and whoever you pick on has to pay it, don't they?
Not necessarily. First, on the facts in this case and all the latex cases, nobody ever stepped in and entered an appearance for Owens & Minor. To use Justice Medina's term, the vendor's endorsement never kicked in. They did not enter an appearance for us. They did not answer the petition for us. They did not answer discovery.
But he says
us.
That's because y'all said not just us, but for everybody.
Not necessarily. If the court looks at the letters that they wrote, one of the preconditions was that we would have to send them documentation that we distributed gloves to the plaintiff's work sites at the time he or she claimed to be exposed. That's in point three of the letter at I think, record site 888. In any event, in the Burden case, we couldn't meet that condition because we didn't distribute any gloves for any manufacturer. We were in exactly the same position as Fitzgerald in the Fitzgerald case. We didn't distribute any gloves to the work sites, so how can we give Beck and Dickinson its mandatory documentation that we distributed gloves to the plaintiff's work sites? That is why that's...
So you would have dropped your agreement. You would have dropped your demand that they defend all of the... everything, all the products.
Well, in Texas, we think that they do owe that. That's the duty...
So you wouldn't have dropped it?
We wouldn't, not in Texas. That's correct. The letter that Mr. Epstein refers to didn't even address Texas.
So the effect, I mean, just to make it clear, let's say Ansel is sued and prevails on a motion for summary judgment and is completely out of the lawsuit and for good reason. Their product had nothing to do with any of the injuries that were claimed. They continue to have to pay defense costs and to indemnify you throughout the litigation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And is there aside from the terms of the statute itself, where's the, even if we look at equity, where's the fairness in that?
Well, two points, Your Honor. First is what I consider to be the much broader point, and that is, that Owens & Minor is an innocent seller because all it does is distribute sealed products from the Becton Dickinson truck to a hospital, and it waits in our warehouse for a couple weeks while the hospital decides that they're ready to use it.
Okay.
So the question is, how fair is it that Owens & Minor is sued in products liability litigation? That goes back to 1967 when, in the McKesson case, where this court determined that distributors who are vicariously liable can be sued in products liability litigation. So really, that's the overarching issue of fairness. The legislature corrected that fundamental unfairness that a company like Owens & Minor, which did nothing more than keep a pallet of gloves in its warehouse for 3 weeks, can be sued in the Burden case and in 20 other cases in Texas. That correction is in 82.02 because it reverses the field, so to speak. It puts the duty on the manufacturer to come back in and defend the distributor, except in those instances where the seller committed independent negligence. The significance is that the duty has to be triggered at the outset, as this court has held.
Is there any way for a manufacturer to defend itself through insurance or other than its own product?
Your Honor, that has never happened in this case. I've been Owens & Minor's counsel for 9 years now, and no manufacturer has ever honored a vendor's endorsement for Owens & Minor. They simply raise the same objections that they've raised with respect to the statute, and that is, if there are other manufacturers sued, we will not defend them. There is, in terms of insurance, there certainly has to be some way for the product to be developed. That's an area that I'm not completely familiar with, but my understanding of insurance is that you can arrange a policy however you'd like. And in this case, what we're really talking about practically is one manufacturer stepping in and providing a defense. Or better yet, as Becton Dickinson did in the hypodermic needle litigation, they got together with all the other manufacturers and appointed separate counsel for all the distributors. The manufacturers in hypodermic needle litigation, which, by the way, was pending in Texas at the same time as this litigation, got together and decided to appoint one set of lawyers for all the distributors.
I asked the other side, do you agree that this case decides for Cade?
Everything except the attorney's fees, correct, Your Honor. That is correct.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Redmond. That concludes the argument and all arguments this morning. And the court marshal will now adjourn the court.